Coon Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
The Herald Scotland. On Wednesday, the 13th of March, 2024. From the news section. Direct Line rebuffs second takeover offer from Belgian rival. An article written by Christy Dorsey and read by me, Corey. Shares in Direct Line tumbled this morning after the insurance group confirmed that it had received and rejected a second takeover offer from a European rival. The revised terms of the cash and shares offer from Belgium Aegis, received on March 9th, implies a value of 237 pence per Direct Line share. This compares to an implied value of 233 pence per share in an initial offer rejected by Direct Line on February 28th. Quote, the board considered the latest proposal with its advisors and continues to believe the latest proposal is uncertain, unattractive, and that it significantly undervalues Direct Line Group and its future prospects while also being highly opportunistic in nature, the company said. Accordingly, the board unanimously rejected the latest proposal. End quote. Direct Line is the UK's second largest motor insurance group with approximately 1,000 employees in Scotland, the majority of whom employed out of Direct Line House in Glasgow's Cardigan Street. Its other brands include Churchill, Green Flag, Privilege, Darwin, NIG and DLG. The group has been hit by sluggish profits as the industry has struggled amid higher prices for used cars, more expensive parts and long repair times. Direct Line was also hit at the end of last year by £30 million in compensation payments to customers who were overcharged when they renewed their car or home insurance. The company is now under the stewardship of Chief Executive Adam Winslow, who took up the post at the beginning of this month, following last year's departure of Penny James. In a research note last month, after the first takeover approach, analyst at Jefferies said Aegis would likely need to make an offer of 270 pence to 300 pence per share in order for it to be accepted. Hans de Kuyper, chief executive of Aegis, described the latest offer of 237 pence as compelling. Quote, our improved possible offer delivers substantial cash proceeds to Direct Line shareholders, whilst ensuring they benefit from the material value creation that we believe the combination of the UK business of Aegis and Direct Line will deliver, he added. Shares in Direct Line fell by more than 9% in early trading, but regained some ground and were trading 5% lower as of midday. That article is from the Herald Scotland. It was from the news section. It was written by Christy Dorsey and it was read by me, Corey. The Herald Scotland. On Wednesday, the 13th of March, 2024. From the news section. Extremely disappointed, Scotland not included in Horizon Law. An article written by Jodie Harrison and read by me, Corey. Scotland's Justice Secretary has said it is extremely disappointing that a law quashing wrongful convictions of sub-postmasters caught up in the Horizon IT scandal will not apply to Scotland. The legislation being included by the UK government on Wednesday will exonerate those convicted in England and Wales on the basis of the faulty Horizon accounting software. Angela Constance said it is not too late for the UK government to change its position, but that if it does not do so, Holyrood will continue Scottish legislation that delivers justice for all those affected. More than 700 postmasters were prosecuted by the Post Office and handed criminal convictions between 1999 and 2015, as Fujitsu's faulty Horizon IT system made it appear as though money was missing at their branches. Around 100 Post Office postmasters in Scotland were among those convicted after being wrongfully accused of embezzling money. Ms. Constance said, "We, along with the Northern Ireland Executive, urge the UK government to introduce UK-wide legislation as the best way to ensure there is a quick, fair and equal solution for all affected postmasters, particularly as the post office is reserved to Westminster. So this announcement is extremely disappointing. It is not too late for the UK government to change their position. But if this continues to be refused, we will introduce Scottish legislation that delivers justice for all those affected. It is likely that this would need to be passed after a UK bill is passed to ensure full compatibility with UK legislation and the UK compensation system, in which the Scottish Government has no locus. But we will do everything in our power to work as quickly as possible." Ms. Constance last week warned victims of the Horizon scandal in Scotland that some delays may be inevitable if Holyrood has to introduce its own legislation to exonerate them. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said the proposed Post Office Horizon System Offences Bill marks an important step forward in finally clearing the names of hundreds of wronged branch managers who have had their lives callously torn apart. Downing Street said that, under the law, convictions in England and Wales will be automatically quashed if they meet the following criteria: were prosecuted by the Post Office or Crown Prosecution Service, were for offences carried out in connection with post office business between 1996 and 2018, were for relevant offences such as theft, fraud or false accounting, were against postmasters, their employees, officers, family members or direct employees of the post office working in a post office that used the Horizon system software. Those with overturned convictions will receive an interim payment with the option of immediately taking a fixed or final offer of £600,000, according to Number 10. The government will also bring forward enhanced financial redress for postmasters who, while not convicted or part of legal action against the post office, made good the apparent losses caused by the Horizon system from their own pockets. They will be entitled to a fixed sum of £75,000 through the Horizon Shortfall Scheme, Downing Street said. Those who have already settled for less money will have their compensation topped up to this level, while people can instead choose to have their claims assessed as part of the usual scheme process, in which there is no limit to compensation. The UK government hopes the bill will receive royal assent and become law ahead of MPs summer holiday. That article was from the Herald Scotland. It was from the news section. It was written by Jodie Harrison, and it was read by me, Corey.
From the Herald Scotland, Thursday the 14th of March, from the sports section, Rangers 0, Benfica 1. Aggregate, Rangers 2, Benfica 3. Instant reaction to the burning issues, by Matthew Lindsay. Rangers paid a high price for their lack of ruthlessness up front tonight when they lost to Benfica in the second leg of their Europa League last 16 doubleheader at Ibrox to crash out of the competition. Philip Camont's side, who had drawn the first leg 2-2 in Lisbon last week, did more than enough to beat Roger Schmidt's star-studded side over the course of the 90 minutes and progress to the quarter-finals. However, they failed to convert any of the scoring opportunities they created going forward, and the Portuguese champions hit them with a sucker punch in the 66th minute when Rafa Silva scored on the breakaway. It was a cruel end to a European campaign which had seen them top their group. Here are five talking points from the bitterly disappointing result. Early risers. The 5:45pm kickoff time, which this encounter was given due to UEFA broadcaster commitments, irked Rangers and their thousands of followers. Still, that did not prevent a sellout crowd from filling through the turnstiles and creating a raucous and raw atmosphere inside the famous old Govan ground. There was a healthy smattering of the visitors' disciples in the corner between the Brunlum stand and Sandy Jardine stand. The tournament organisers stipulate that the away team must receive 5% of the ticket allocation, and that helped no end. But the Bears certainly rose to the occasion. Nicolas Otamendi and his teammates were hit with a wall of noise as they came out of the tunnel. Fabio Silva gestured at them to raise the decibel levels after the Benfica goalkeeper, Antoli Turbin, had allowed a Tom Warren shot to go out of play for a corner, but he really had no need to do so. There was a minute's applause during the first half in memory of the fan who passed away in Lisbon last week, and there were plenty for the spectators to clap on the park. Tavernier and his teammates controlled possession, albeit without creating many clear-cut chances in the final third, and were comfortably the better of the two sides. When one team dominates to such a degree and fails to score, they always run the risk of paying the price and conceding on the counter. That is exactly what happened. Benfica broke from their own half, Silva got through 1-1 with Jack Butland and kept his composure. Rock solid Butland. No Rangers player has represented England since the legendary Paul Gascoigne did so way back in 1997. But it was still something of a surprise when Butland was today left out of Gareth Southgate's national squad for the friendly internationals against Brazil and Belgium later this month. Jordan Pickford of Everton is very much his country's first-choice goalkeeper. But neither Sam Johnson of Crystal Palace nor Aaron Ramsdale of Arsenal have been playing with the same regularity or consistency as Butland this season. The 9-times-capped 31-year-old has certainly performed superbly against Aris Limassol, Real Betis and Sparta Prague in the Europa League in recent months. He would have been determined to do the same thing once again tonight and show Southgate what he is missing after his England recall failed to materialise. Butland was tested early on when Frederik Arsenis tried his luck from range. It was a bread-and-butter save in ordinary circumstances, but the slippy surface made it a challenge, and he did well to keep the scoreline level. He held a Kasper Tingstad shot in the second half and tipped an Alexander Ba effort past his post. He could do nothing about the goal. The right stuff. The loss of Dujon Sterling, who had scored his first goal in senior football in the Estadio de la Luz last week, to injury, was a blow to Camont. Ross McCausland, another to suffer a knock in the Scottish Gas Scottish Cup quarter-final win over Hibernian at Easter Road on Sunday, was not deemed fit enough to start. That presented an unexpected opportunity to Scott Wright on the right flank. The Scots had not been a regular starter for Rangers once again this term. The only European game he had featured in from kickoff before this evening was the loss to Aris in Cyprus back in October. He has, though, a wealth of experience on the continent. right to help the Ibrox club come from behind and defeat RB Leipzig in the Europa League semi-final 2 years ago, after Kemar Roofe was ruled out. He made a nuisance of himself from the first whistle. He did well to get on of a silver chip and head into the six-yard box early on and forced Orsnes to concede a corner. He soldiered on after receiving medical attention for a head knock and fired over the crossbar on the half-hour mark. He did superbly to tee up Cyril Dessers for a shot early in the second half, and the striker was unlucky that his attempt was deflected wide by Orsnes. He was cheered off when he was replaced by Rabi Matondo. Clinical Benfica. Benfica manager Schmidt is under pressure from fans at the moment, despite his team being in second spot in the Primeira Liga table, just a point behind leaders Sporting Lisbon. Losing 5-0 to Porto has not gone down well with the Eagles' diehards. The German threw on Danish forward Tengstad for Brazilian striker Leonardo at the start of the second half, and then replaced David Neres with Orkun Kokku in the hope it would spark his men to life. They took the lead against the run of play with 24 minutes of regulation time remaining, after a VAR check showed winger Silva had not been offside. If you don't take your chances, Clement has not been happy with the injuries he has had to contend with since he arrived in Glasgow, and it was easy to see why this evening. Rangers acquitted themselves admirably throughout, however, they lacked a cutting edge in attack. Would it have been a different story if Oscar Cortez, Danilo, Abdallah Sima or Sterling had played? Matondo took over from right, Todd Cantwell came on for Lawrence, and Roofe replaced Dessers in the closing stages, but they were unable to make a difference. It was just the third defeat their Belgian manager has suffered in Scotland. And that report was by Matthew Lindsay.
This is from the Herald Scotland on Wednesday the 13th of March 2024. From the Voices section. My father's death from alcohol was a source of shame. This article is written by Katrina Stewart. I have more fingers on my one hand than I have facts about my father. Let me rhyme them off. His name was John, although because his family were Highlanders, they called him Ian. He went to Hindland Secondary School in Glasgow. As a student, he worked in the ticket office in Queen Street Station. And he was an alcoholic. That last is a fact I've never said publicly before. In the past couple of weeks, I've been interviewing people living with an alcohol addiction, and every one of them spoke of shame and how it stopped them seeking help. Shame is terrible, one woman told me. It keeps you silent. One man I interviewed, David, told me that after 40 years of drinking, he is now in recovery. A miraculous thing has happened. He had last seen his daughter 20 years before, when she was 5, and he found her on Facebook. They were talking again. He was prioritizing her needs, taking things slowly, but desperate to build a relationship with her again. Imagine that. Your daughter is out there, unknown, and then here, on your computer screen, within reach. To my embarrassment, because it is self-indulgent and deeply unprofessional, I started to cry. For the bulk of my childhood, this is what I had wanted, for my father to reappear, preferably full of contrition, and having remarried and created me some half-sisters. But I would have taken what I was given. All I knew was that I had no father. I didn't know why, and so I internalized it. She must have been a pretty awful kid if her own father wasn't interested. I worked diligently at school and my extracurricular activities to try to be the sort of girl whose father would want to be around. I knew my parents had been married, but the man was never, ever mentioned. My mother, like Mary, who I learned about at church, of course I went on to be a Sunday school teacher, had all but produced me single-handedly. I had no anger over being abandoned, just hope of a sunlit return. You don't really think about how much you have when you're a child, and I had plenty. You focus on what your peers have, and you want that too. A dad is a trickier than the newest My Little Pony. You can't get one with pocket money. Instead, I filled in the gaps, invented a new life, and a cover story for him. Aging is to be increasingly haunted. I have a much beloved but estranged aunt, and I see her face now when I look in the mirror, which is a particularly eerie form of possession. An opaque ghost father followed me for many years, and then, when I was in my late teens, he died. So that was that. I'd been so spurred by hope until his death. There was, however, still no mention of what killed him. As an adult, living in Australia, where he lived his last years, I went to the births, deaths and marriage register to get his death certificate, thinking it may be of some use. Next to children, it said none, which felt personal but also frustrating, as I'd wasted a beautiful Sydney afternoon in an administrative office in Pyrmont when I could have been at the beach. Though there was some use to it, it told me that he had died of liver cirrhosis, and suddenly the silence made sense. The shame of addiction can be pervasive, not only for the addicted person, but also the family. My mother had always placed great store in being of good character, and I felt I could never mention his alcoholism because it would damage my good character. I was angry about it, furious. I had missed out on having a father because he chose to drink instead. What an abdication of responsibility. What an insult. I stopped caring, the little bit that I had. My dear friend also had an alcoholic father and tells dreadful stories of the humiliation wrought by his behaviour and the strain on his mother keeping the family ticking on. It was, I decided, a blessing that he had absented himself. I began to understand how difficult this all must have been for my mother, and understood the situation to be her story and really very little to do with me. I have said exactly this before, but it bears repeating. I know lots of fatherless children, and we all have our stories. The fathers become ciphers in these tales. They become who we need them to be in order to explain away our foibles and bad habits. We have lost them to alcohol and suicide and illness and accident, sometimes just plain fecklessness or even disinterest. And we think it makes us interesting, but in fact it doesn't. It makes us common. There's probably some useful examination to be done on the effect of fatherlessness. I would say none for me, no effect, but that is more likely arrogance and an unattractive resistance to self-examination. I think I deal poorly with rejection as a result. I form very strong attachments. If you are my friend, then I would drag bodies across floors for you, no questions. It has given me the sense that men are entirely superfluous, which is probably a little unfair, and given me an absolute and pure love for my male friends who are helping correct that unfairness. Most of my male friends have been involved in the production of boys, but the odd two or three have small daughters, and I love them all the more for their openness and dedication to the task of raising girls. Being envious of toddlers for their devoted dads is quite an unedifying space to occupy, let me tell you. But it's coupled with love. When I read the MSP Monica Lennon's letter to her father, who was also addicted to alcohol and who died, I thought about what I might say to my own. Nothing, I don't think. But I still have felt too ashamed of his addiction to talk about it, which is ludicrous because I have so much compassion for other people who are similarly afflicted, and an understanding of the harm of shame. Men like my father in the west of Scotland and elsewhere die of silence. Yet alcoholism is nothing more or less than a fact. Actually, I have now some more facts. On Sunday, I finally asked my mum about him, and I learned that he liked to read. He always had a book in his back pocket and was fond of the Beat Poets. I love to read too. You get that from him, my mum said. It was the first time I'd ever really thought of him as a person. And that's something to be ashamed of, that fact. That article was written by Katrina Stewart. This is from the Herald Scotland, on Thursday the 14th of March 2024, from the news section. Three-car fire in Glasgow, being treated as deliberate. This article is written by Gabriel Mackay. Police believe three cars in Glasgow were deliberately set alight in an incident on Monday night. As previously reported by the Herald, fire crews were deployed to Boyd Street at around 11:40 p.m. with three vehicles in flames. A red Mitsubishi, a red Honda and a black Vauxhall were extinguished by the Scottish Fire and Rescue Service and no injuries were reported. Police Scotland have now said that the incident is being treated as a willful fire-raising as they appealed for information. Detective Constable Mark McCall said, "Thankfully, no one was hurt as a result of this incident. Our inquiries are ongoing, and I am appealing for anyone who may have witnessed the incident or who may have any information which could assist us to get in touch. I would also appeal to anyone with dashcam footage or private CCTV, which could help, to contact us." A spokesperson for the Scottish Fire and Rescue Service said, "We were alerted at 11:35 p.m. on Monday the 11th of March to reports of three cars on fire in Boyd Street, Glasgow. Operations Control mobilised three fire appliances to the scene, where firefighters extinguished the flames. No casualties were reported and the crews left after ensuring the area was made safe." That article was written by Gabriel Mackay. This is from the Herald Scotland, on Thursday the 14th of March 2024, from the news section. Top Edinburgh tourist attraction launches brand new tour. This article is written by Craig Williams. Edinburgh tourist attraction, The Real Mary King's Close, has launched a brand new tour based on 17th century medicine with the Edinburgh Science Festival. The new medical history tour will explore the nature and development of Edinburgh's last plague outbreak, as well as the stories of Scots who revolutionised medicine to make it what it is today, all while exploring Edinburgh's iconic underground street. Guests will learn about everything from the unusual methods of diagnoses employed by local apothecaries, such as former resident of Mary King's Close, Dr. Arnott, to the city's worst plague outbreak. Due to overcrowding within the city walls, the plague permeated the area in 1645. Those suffering from the plague would hang a white sheet from their window to warn their neighbours to keep away, quarantining themselves while awaiting a visit from the plague doctor. Visitors will also learn about key moments in history that defined 19th century medicine, such as the formation of the Edinburgh Seven, an all-female group of aspiring doctors spearheaded by Sophia Jex Blake, who fought for women's education and the right to practice medicine. The story of Dr. James Barry is also highlighted on the tour, a renowned military surgeon who performed the first successful caesarean section in the British Empire. The new medical history tours form part of Edinburgh Science Festival, running from March the 30th to April the 14th. Paul Nixon, general manager at the Real Mary King's Close, said, "We're really looking forward to welcoming people to our brand new medical history tours at the Real Mary King's Close. On the tour, we delve into fascinating history of the medical scene here in Edinburgh, hearing from pioneers in the field. Our team is passionate about telling powerful stories and educating people about Edinburgh's rich history. We can't wait to see new and familiar faces on the tour and look forward to inspiring the next generation of budding doctors. Tours are available on Saturday, March the 30th, Saturday, April the 6th, and Saturday, April the 13th. Tickets are £27 per adult, £22 per child. That article was written by Craig Williams.
This is from the Herald Scotland on Friday, the 15th of March, 2024. From the news section. MSPs say public board quota rules definition of women should change. Article by Jodie Harrison. MSPs have approved the removal of a controversial definition of women from legislation which aims to increase female participation on public boards. The Scottish Parliament's Equalities Committee recommended the amendment to the Gender Representation on Public Boards Act. The Act, passed in 2018, sets the aim of having 50% of women as non-executive members on public boards. The original legislation defined a woman to include all transgender women, regardless of whether they had a Gender Recognition Certificate, GRC. The amended version, if approved by the wider Scottish Parliament, will remove the definition of a woman which includes a person who has the protected characteristic of gender reassignment, if, and only if, the person is living as a woman and is proposing to undergo or has undergone a process or part of the process for the purpose of becoming female. It came after Feminist Campaigners for Women Scotland challenged the definition in the Court of Session, which ruled the wording unlawful. Effective from April 2022, a senior judge stated Holyrood did not have the legislative competence to expand the definition of woman. The ruling said it impinged on protected characteristics within the Reserved Equality Act 2010. Last year, ministers put the amended version of the Act before Parliament to remove the definition. Committee convener Karen Adams said, "Our committee is satisfied that this bill provides a technical fix in order to tidy up the statute book following the rulings of the Court of Session. We would like to thank everyone who shared their views with us during the consultation period. The Act will still allow trans women with a GRC to be counted as part of the gender balance scheme." That article was by Jodie Harrison. This is from the Herald Scotland on Friday, the 15th of March, 2024. From the news section. Scientists turn chewing gum into green LFT devices. Article by Helen McArdle, health correspondent. An Edinburgh-based scientist has shown how discarded chewing gum can be turned into lateral flow tests, LFTs, to help cut medical waste across the world. Mawen Kersaudi Kerhoas, a professor in microfluidic engineering at Heriot-Watt University, worked with Northamptonshire-based moulding company Great Central Plastics to develop 5 prototype devices made from a range of emerging plastic materials as part of her work to make the healthcare industry more sustainable. In addition to post-consumer chewing gum, GumTech, collected from streets across the UK, the team has also created LFTs using old fridge parts made from high-impact polystyrenes, HIPs, which are 100% recyclable plastic. It is estimated there are over 4 billion lateral flow tests manufactured annually, and the market is set to grow from $43 billion in 2022 to $72 billion, £56 billion, by the end of 2024. Around 16,000 tonnes of plastics are produced globally for rapid testing every year, with an average test containing 10 to 15 grams of single-use virgin plastic. Because of issues due to sorting and potential contamination, very few of the plastics used in medical testing are recycled, and most of it is sent to incineration or landfill. A further 3 prototype LFTs have been made from Limex, a material derived from limestone, with 50 to 80% calcium carbonate in the final product, pterylene, biocompounds based on polyethylene, PE, made from renewable raw materials, and Bioflex, a biodegradable and compostable type of plastic. LFTs entered the public consciousness during the COVID pandemic, but they are also used in pregnancy tests and to identify a range of illnesses and conditions, including strep A, preeclampsia, and mosquito-borne diseases such as malaria or dengue fever. Together with masks, they have been the visible part of the growing medical waste issue. Professor Kersaudi Karhous, a lead academic at Heriot-Watt University's new Global Research Institute in Health and Care Technologies, said, "If we can make LFTs out of sustainable materials and without the use of fossil fuels in their production, we can save between 30 and 80% of carbon emissions that virgin plastic processing produces. We've now had approval to test these prototypes, making sure they function as well as the existing ones, particularly regarding the flow of liquid on the testing strip. As well as demonstrating feasibility in their practical application, these new devices help to support a wide-ranging discussion around healthcare sustainability in general and how we might develop a circular economy through potential changes in procurement and legislation." The Sustainable LFTs project is part of a collaboration with social scientists at the University of Edinburgh and is part funded by the Diadev project, investigating the design and use of diagnostic devices in global health, funded by the European Research Council under the European Union's Horizon 2020 Research and Innovation Programme. Steve McLaughlin, Deputy Principal for Research and Impact at Heriot-Watt and the Director of Health and Care Technologies, said, "Mavin and her team have been passionate about reducing medical waste throughout their careers, and the figures make it obvious why this is such an urgent issue. The mission of the new Global Research Institute in Health and Care Technologies is to work closely with industry and sector partners to deliver innovative, sustainable, and use-inspired solutions to help solve global health challenges in a spirit of co-creation. The work Mavin is doing on sustainable LFTs is exactly the sort of project we want to support, and we have the world-leading research and engineering capabilities here at Heriot-Watt to do it." Alice Street, a professor of anthropology and health at Edinburgh University and principal investigator of the Diadev project, added, "LFTs are used globally to test for a growing number of diseases, and are especially important in low-resource settings, but not enough attention has been paid to the plastic waste they generate. This project brought together social sciences research, showing the impact of LFT waste around the world, with innovative approaches in biomedical engineering to create long-overdue solutions to the growing problem of medical waste. In addition to manufacturing the green LFT prototypes, Great Central Plastics generates around a third of its energy from roof-mounted solar panels. As much as possible, it tries to use reprocessed and recycled materials." Kieran Phillips, its head of sales and marketing, said, "We take pride in our sustainable manufacturing processes, and we adopt this ethos across all levels of our business. This collaboration highlights our commitment to cutting-edge research and development. By championing sustainable alternatives, such as GumTech and Limex, we not only mitigate environmental impact, but also pioneer a shift in the industry, setting a benchmark for responsible production practices." That article was by Helen McArdle.
The Herald on the 15th of March and the Arts and Ends section. Glasgow Comedy Festival reveals Billy Connolly Award shortlist by Gabriel Mackay. The six comics nominated for the Sir Billy Connolly Spirit of Glasgow Award have been revealed as the city's comedy festival has got underway. An independent panel of judges made recommendations to Sir Billy, who ultimately decides the overall winner, who is a comedian judged to best represent the spirit of Scotland's biggest city. Judges included 2023 award winner Janie Godley, Barbie star Sharon Rooney, legendary comic Jonathan Watson, STV News presenter Laura Boyd, actor Tony Curran, Glasgow's Lord Provost Jacqueline McLaren, as well as Herald editor Catherine Salmond. Craig Hill, Raymond Mearns, Roscoe McClellan, Susan Riddle, Susan McCabe, and Zara Gladman are the six nominees for the 2024 edition, which will be announced at the Glasgow International Comedies Festival Gala on Saturday, March 20 at the King's Theatre. Craig Hill, who's been performing for over 25 years, said, "I'm absolutely thrilled to be nominated for this award, not only because it's about the spirit of Glasgow, which definitely feeds into the way I look at life and the things I laugh at, but it's in the name of Glasgow's comedy hero, Billy Connolly. It's an honour to be nominated for an award in his name. When it comes to awards, this is the big one." Nominated for the first time in his 15 years career, Glaswegian comedian Raymond Mearns said, "Surprised and delighted to be nominated for this award. To make my living as a stand-up is already a dream come true, and coming from Glasgow with Billy Connolly as my inspiration, I was able to stand on the shoulders of a giant." Roscoe McClellan, Scottish Comedian of the Year 2016, said, "The spirit of Billy visited me in a dream to tell me that I've been shortlisted for this award, and he started licking my face, which was strange but oddly comforting. Then I woke up and it was just my dog who needed out. I'm very proud to be shortlisted for this." Scott Squad contributor and sketch comic Susan Riddle, receiving her first nomination, said, "I'm absolutely buzzing to be shortlisted for this award. I'm biased, but Glasgow is one of the funniest cities in the world, and to be in the running for an award endorsed by the Big Un is the biggest honour." Susie McCabe said, "To be nominated for this Billy Connolly Spirit of Glasgow Award is a massive honour, not only an award with the godfather of modern stand-up comedy associated with it, but a man who defined this city. What a wonderful city it is. If you're from the city, you've been blessed. Maybe not so much with the weather, though." Zara Gladman, who's achieved viral success with her West End Mum and other characters, said, "I'm in complete shock. First, Billy Connolly to even read my name on a piece of paper is a huge honour. My Glasgow West End Mum will be boasting about this for years to come." The Glasgow International Comedy Festival kicked off on Wednesday this week and will run at more than 50 venues across the city over 19 days. Festival director Kirsten McDonald said, "Over the next few weeks, Glasgow will showcase exactly why we think it's the funniest city in the world, as locals and visitors alike are entertained by some of the very best comics around. We hope to see old friends and new friends and out and about at GICF shows, celebrating our thriving comedy scene. Plus, a huge congratulations to this year's Sir Billy Connolly Spirit of Glasgow Award shortlist. Caliber of entries was outstanding, so it's a real achievement to be recognised in this way. We're looking forward to celebrating the shortlist and final winner this year's Comedy Gala." Chair of Glasgow Life, Bailey Annette Christine, said, "The exciting shortlist of finalists for this prestigious award emphasises the wealth of outstanding homegrown talent appearing at this year's Glasgow International Comedy Festival, which has a dynamic, packed programme and a fantastic lineup of artists. Honouring the city's beloved comedy maestro, the Sir Billy Connolly Spirit of Glasgow Award not only recognises the best in the business, it also reflects Glasgow's great appreciation of comedy genius and the importance of humour in our lives. Our city and its people are renowned for their love of quick wit and banter, so Glasgow has a well-deserved reputation as a headline name on the worldwide comedy stage, a fabulous destination for fun-filled entertainment." And that was by Gabriel Mackay.
From the Herald Scotland, Sunday the 17th of March. From the news section, Henry Wooga, Glasgow Holocaust educator, dies aged 100. This report is by Gabriel Mackay. Henry Wooga, a Jewish refugee who came to Glasgow to escape Nazi persecution and became a leading educator on the Holocaust, has died aged 100. The Holocaust Day Memorial Trust said it was heartbroken to announce his passing on Sunday morning. Born in Heinz, Martin Wooga in Nuremberg on February 23rd, 1924. Mr. Wooga escaped Nazi Germany to Glasgow, aged 15, on Kinder transport and was taken in by Mrs. Etta Horvich, a Jewish immigrant from Latvia. Aged 16, he was interned on the Isle of Man for trying to correspond via relatives in France and Belgium with his parents on charges of corresponding with the enemy. He later married Ingrid Wolf, a fellow German Jewish refugee, and they raised a family in Glasgow, with the pair regularly going into schools to give talks on the Holocaust. A fan of Scotland's national bard, Robert Burns, Mr. Wooga helped create a dedicated educational resource using Burns' poetry and his own testimony to mark Holocaust Memorial Day. He is survived by 2 children, 4 grandchildren and 3 great-grandchildren. Olivia Marks Walden OBE, Chief Executive of Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, said, "We are heartbroken at the passing of Henry Wooga MBE. Henry was a gentleman, charming, dapper and above all a force for good. The work that he and his late wife Ingrid did in sharing their testimonies made an immense impact on thousands of people across Scotland. All of us at the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust send our deepest sympathies to his daughters, Hilary and Gillian, and all his family and loved ones. Thank you for everything, Henry. We will miss you." And that report was by Gabriel Mackay. From the Herald Scotland, Sunday the 17th of March, from the news section, exclusive, Slater told to put targets on cutting consumption in bill. This article is written by Kathleen Nutt, political correspondent. Ministers are being urged to introduce legal targets on reducing consumption as Lorna Slater prepares to take major legislation to protect the environment to a key stage in Holyrood later this week. The call comes as Holyrood is due to debate and vote on the Circular Economy Bill on Thursday, with politicians facing demands to bring in tougher measures to cut the number of items consumed in order to reduce the volume of discarded plastics and other items. Currently, Scotland has mandatory targets to reduce domestic climate emissions, but no plan for reducing the emissions from imported goods. Such a situation would change if consumption reduction targets were introduced as part of the new circular economy law, campaigners say. Kim Pratt, circular economy campaigner at Friends of the Earth Scotland, called for MSPs to support the general principles of the bill on Thursday, but to strengthen the measures in the bill, including proposing legal targets on reducing consumption as it makes its way through the Holyrood legislative process. She said, "The new circular economy law has the potential to significantly reduce Scotland's contribution to climate breakdown. At the moment, consumption is spiralling out of control and our politicians need to grasp this opportunity for action. People and the environment are paying the costs of our throwaway society every day, whether that is products that break easily or precious natural resources that are being wasted. System-wide changes are needed, such as ensuring businesses pay for the clean-up of their products, increased access to reuse and repair service, and standardised recycling for all. We need to see MSPs from across the political spectrum coming together to support this vital law, and, as the legislative process continues in the coming months, they must push it on to be stronger and more effective, with mandatory targets to reduce consumption." Laura Alcock-Ferguson, Circular Communities Scotland CEO, said, "Communities in Scotland will benefit from a strong and ambitious circular economy bill that addresses the twin challenges of overconsumption and the wider climate emergency. In addition to strong targets that will bring down consumption, politicians should ensure that they focus the bill's priorities further up the waste hierarchy to reuse, repair and behaviour change activities. This will help to ensure the bill lives up to its potential, allowing for meaningful circular change in Scotland." Members of Holyrood's Net Zero Energy and Transport Committee last month welcomed the Circular Economy Scotland Bill, but found that its proposals to reduce waste and boost recycling rates were limited in their ambitions. Their report stated, "The measures proposed by the Scottish Government in this bill are well intended and most should have a positive impact. However, the committee remains unconvinced that the bill on its own will create the systems-wide change needed in Scotland to fully close the loop. There is a heavy focus in the bill on waste management, littering and fly-tipping. Less so on tackling consumption and concrete measures to ensure repair and reuse." It went on to say that the Scottish Government must consider further action and said it was supportive in principle of statutory circular economy targets. It added, "Setting targets should be an obligation, not an option. Given the importance of statutory targets as a mechanism for enacting transformative change, we recommend amendments are made at stage 2 to specify the Scottish ministers must rather than may create targets. The committee further recommends timescales for the introduction of targets proportionate with the urgency of the issue are specified. The committee did not specify which targets should be introduced. Suggestions made to the committee include ones on national reuse and repair, food waste, and carbon and material-based consumption reduction. The committee also recommended that Scotland should standardise household bin collections to improve recycling and reduce the amount of waste going to landfill. Different systems operate across 32 local authorities, and there are a wide range of recycling rates. In some places, glass is picked up from the curbside, while in others people have to travel to bottle banks. There are also myriad different coloured bins in various local authorities, and some have at least 6 for people to sort waste into. This causes difficulties about how some items fit into those schemes, as well as confusion about the times when each bin is to be collected, the MSP says. Campaigners say, 84% of Scotland's carbon footprint comes from the products and services we buy. More than half of Scotland's emissions are due to imported goods, but these are not included in the country's domestic climate targets. Scotland consumed more than 100 million tonnes of material in 2018, which is 19 tonnes of material per person on average. Experts have stated that it is possible to live sustainable, high-quality lives on a material footprint of 8 tonnes of materials per person per year. Ms. Slater said, "We want to create a circular economy in which resources are kept in use for as long as possible. This is not just good for the environment, it will also create new economic opportunities and green jobs here in Scotland." The Scottish Government's Circular Economy Bill will establish a legislative framework to support that, including giving ministers the powers to introduce statutory targets that would help achieve our goals. Our proposed restrictions on the destruction of unsold goods would also help tackle unnecessary waste. And that article was an exclusive by Kathleen Nutt. From the Herald Scotland, Sunday the 17th of March, from the Arts and Entertainment section. Steve Harley of Cockney Rebel dead, aged 73, family announce. By Gabriel Mackay. Cockney Rebel frontman Steve Harley has died peacefully at home at the age of 73, his family have announced. The rock band were best known for their hit Make Me Smile, Come Up and See Me, which went to number 1 in the UK charts in 1975. A statement from his daughter Greta said, "We are devastated to announce that our wonderful husband and father has passed away peacefully at home, with his family by his side. The birdsong from his woodland that he loved so much was singing for him. His home has been filled with the sounds of laughter of his 4 grandchildren. Stephen, Steve, Dad, Grandar, Steve Harley. Whoever you know him as, his heart exuded only core elements. Passion, kindness, generosity, and much more in abundance. We know he will be desperately missed by people all over the world, and we ask you to respectfully allow us privacy to grieve." And that article was written by Gabriel Mackay. From the Herald Scotland, Sunday the 17th of March, from the sports section. Interview: Rangers boss Philippe Clement blasts Dundee pitch and call-off process. By Christopher Jack, senior Rangers writer. Philippe Clement blasted the state of the Dens Park pitch in a process that saw Rangers' premiership fixture with Dundee postponed just 90 minutes before kick-off. The match was called off after heavy rain left the pitch unplayable in parts. Referee Don Robertson made the decision on his arrival at the stadium after an initial inspection at 9:15 a.m. by local whistler Craig Fordyce. The call-off denied Rangers the chance to regain top spot in the premiership heading into the international break, after Celtic moved clear with victory over St Johnstone on Saturday. Rangers are next in league action when Hibernian make their trip to Ibrox on Saturday, March the 30th. And Clement was less than impressed with the way a shambolic series of events unfolded, as Rangers discovered the match was postponed just minutes from their arrival at the stadium. Clement said, "We weren't warned about it, not Saturday evening during the night. I hear now that people started to work on the pitch at 5 o'clock in the morning. So, in that way, they did their best. But we were only told there was an issue because our kitman was at the stadium early, at around 9:15 a.m. He warned us about the situation, and for me that's a really strange thing." This will be the only pitch in all the leagues in Scotland where a game was postponed. That tells me that it has nothing to do with the weather. Yes, it rained, but it rained all over Scotland and there were pitches in other lower leagues where they could play football. There, the ball was bouncing. But here, the ball was not bouncing, so clearly there is something wrong. It is clearly in the rules that if the ball doesn't bounce, you cannot play a game of football. Also, there were spots in the pitch where they had to put lots of sand, and there was no stability for the players. It's really dangerous for injuries. We can say, yes, 50 or 60 years ago, football was played on these kinds of pitches, and that's true. But there has been an evolution, as in those times they also played the game with laces on the football. I think it's a very important thing for the future that a league thinks about how to raise the level of the pitches and put standards on that like they do in other things. They have standards with things like lighting, for example, to have a good broadcast of the game and to have a good product. Sure, the lights are really important, but even more important is the quality of the pitches, I think. Rangers would have been without a handful of first-team stars for the Premiership fixture as Clement continues to deal with the Ibrox injury crisis. But the Belgian insists that that situation never entered his mind as he came to terms with a wasted weekend. "There are only negatives today," Clement said. "We were ready for this game and have two very important weeks to come to play final games before the top six. It's going to be difficult now to put this game in between. And it's a disadvantage if you have a midweek game and the other team has 1 week of preparation. So I don't see any positives from this. We have internationals going away now and we cannot train today. Normally I always find something positive in every situation, but today I cannot see anything positive." And that article was by Christopher Jack. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 18th of March, from the Arts and Entertainment section, "Fleetwood Mac star Stevie Nicks to perform at Glasgow's Ovo Hydro," by Sarah Campbell. Fleetwood Mac star Stevie Nicks has added new UK and Ireland show dates to her 2024 summer tour, with a stop planned for Scotland. It has today been announced that the 75-year-old singer-songwriter is set to perform at the Ovo Hydro on Saturday, July the 6th. Announcing the event online, the Ovo Hydro said, "Announced, the icon that is Stevie Nicks is coming to the Ovo Hydro this summer on July 6th. This will be the first time that the Fleetwood Mac frontwoman has performed in Scotland since 2015, when she headlined the same venue with the band. Support acts have yet to be announced. Tickets for Stevie Nicks live in concert will go on sale from 12 p.m. on Friday, March 22nd, with pre-sale available from Wednesday, March the 20th. They will reportedly be priced between £86 and £85 and £234 and 40 pence. Nicks will also play the Three Arena in Dublin on July the 3rd and the Co-op Live Arena in Manchester on July the 9th. For more information, go to www.ovohydro.com/events. And that report was by Sarah Campbell. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 18th of March, from the Voices section, "Tourists must be disgusted by our litter-stained beauty spots." From the letters page of the Herald Scotland, 18th of March. "We live in a country that has jaw-dropping scenery and wildlife. Yet we are content to deface this beautiful country with litter. Some beauty spots that have litter bins that are full, which go for weeks without being emptied. It's hard to believe that people are happier to empty their cars of litter and leave it on the roadside rather than bag it and take it home. Tourists come to our country in droves, whether by plane, coach, car or organised tours. What must they think as they go through the natural beauty of places like Glencoe, Glenshee, Loch Ness, Loch Lomond and our beautiful islands? None of these places escape the cancer of litter. We should take a pride in our country, and maybe, just maybe, we can proudly promote Bonnie Scotland again. Neil Stewart Balfron. Girls and Girls on Buchanan Street. I often despair of the younger generation and their careless ways. On Saturday lunchtime in a busy suburb, Buchanan Street, I saw two teenage girls casually drop a takeaway container of chips and walk on without a second's thought. Two older women, walking in the opposite direction, were plainly taken aback and glared at the girls. By that time, a couple of hungry gulls were already swooping on the container. The girls went on their merry way. Have these girls' parents or teachers never taught them about the problems that arise from littering? A. Matthews, Glasgow. Off the Ball is a joy to listen to. I have to beg to differ with some comments of Douglas Cowes' letter, March 15th. I find it refreshing that the presenters of Off the Ball don't pretend to be offering anything other than what it says on the tin, delivering the most ill-informed and petty sports programme on radio. It shows a certain confidence to be able to send yourself up and not take yourself too seriously. As someone who has little interest in football, I find that programme just good fun and relaxing banter, with some interesting debate and insights into football and other subjects. Gifted presenters and journalists are able to raise the interests of a topic which the listener slash reader would not normally identify with. I think of sports writer Hugh MacDonald and the late Charlie Allen, the farming reporter whose columns were humorous, entertaining and informative. Maybe I will never develop a deep interest in either sport or farming, but I might grow a wee bit more knowledgeable of subjects which I would never normally engage with. There are also some other excellent programmes of high standard from BBC Radio Scotland, like Travelling Folk and Take the Floor. Although some of the topics covered in the phone-in programmes after 9 o'clock may not be in everybody's interest, I'm always impressed how well the presenters manage to conduct themselves, considering the unpredictability of those who phone in. I'm all for lightweight presenters in this day and age when a lot of what is offered is seriously depressing and gloomy. On a more serious note, I don't think that either Stuart Cosgrove or Tam Cowan, co-presenters of Off the Ball, would call themselves Ouija, Stuart having grown up in Perth and Tam hailing from Motherwell. Irene Munro, Conan Bridge. No, it isn't. It's dire. I totally agree with Douglas Cow about BBC Radio Scotland. I used to make a point of tuning in to Off the Ball for the fantastic banter, impressions and competitions, but now, if I mistakenly twiddle the knob, I've a few seconds of oral voyeurism just to confirm how bad it now is. It should be renamed Off the Boil. And then there's the Saturday football commentary, where 1 minute you can hear Willie Miller smoothly dissecting the weakness in the East Fife defence, only to be blasted off the air by some Bob Campsey wannabe, screaming, "Oh, wee Doddy McBain's just pulled one back for Auchinshugel. Tripped on his laces, heeded the bars, he'd landed it and trundled into the net. Unbelievably fantastic." Unbelievably dire, more like. Alan Sutherland, Stonehaven. BBC can do better than this. I thought I was the only one who had recently got into the habit of switching off BBC Radio Scotland when certain presenters came on, but after reading Douglas Cow's letter, I wholeheartedly agree with the input he succinctly detailed. Come back the likes of Janice Forsyth, who was knowledgeable and articulate in her presenting and was a joy to listen to. The standard of some of the current presenters and output from BBC Radio Scotland almost matches and reinforces the way Scotland is heading just now towards a substandard country. Come on, BBC, you can do better than this. Douglas Eade, Alexandria. Urbane and witty Mike McGahey. Back in 1986 on the London train from Edinburgh, the instantly recognisable Mick McGahey came on board at York and sat opposite me. Letters March 14th. If it matters, we were both travelling second class. We cheerfully blethered away the miles to London, covering an eclectic range of topics that somehow didn't include either politics or the miners' strike. He proved urbane, witty and companionable, exuding such a kindly avuncular air. Most of all, I recall his courtesy, an example to us all. Gordon Casely, Craze. Winford Flats. Will someone please tell me what is the true condition of the 600 Winford Flats? Will someone tell me why 600 flats should be demolished at huge cost to be replaced by half that number when Glasgow is facing a huge problem in housing, its government allocation of refugees and immigrants, not to mention our own homeless? Ronald Singleton, Glasgow. Mulleting it over. Was there ever a competition among the players in the Rugby Six Nations to see who could have the silliest haircut? Gordon Berry, ear. And that was today's The Herald Scotland letters page, Monday the 18th of March. From The Herald Scotland, Monday the 18th of March, from the news section, family pay tribute to man, 65, murdered at the Edinburgh bus stop. Report by Herald Scotland staff. The family of a 65-year-old man murdered in Edinburgh have paid tribute to the loving husband and father. A police investigation into the death of Nasheer Ahmed is continuing following a completely random and unprovoked assault on Sunday, March the 10th. Mr. Ahmed and a friend, a 48-year-old man, were standing at a bus stop on the city's Ferry Road near the junction with Great Junction Street and Coburg Street at around 8:30 p.m. when another man approached and attacked them. Both men were taken to the Royal Infirmary of Edinburgh, but Mr. Ahmed died on Friday, March the 15th, with police then launching a murder investigation. In a statement released by Police Scotland, Mr. Ahmed's family said, "Nasheer was a loving husband and father. He was a big part of our family and we are devastated at losing him. He was heavily involved in Edinburgh's Bangladeshi community and will be greatly missed. He loved life and cared for all his family and friends. We will always remember his warmth and kindness." His friend was discharged after receiving treatment for a serious leg and facial injuries. The attacker is described as black, around 30, with short dark hair. He was wearing a red tartan scarf and a long black jacket with a hood. Detective Inspector George Calder said, "A family has been left feeling bereft as they come to terms with losing someone so integral to their lives. The circumstances are heartbreaking and I can't possibly imagine the pain they are feeling during these difficult times. We continue to follow up several lines of inquiry and I would reiterate my appeal to anyone who has information about this crime or the person responsible to contact us. Any small piece of information could be crucial in our ongoing investigation, so please do pass it on. Those with information are told to contact 101, quoting reference 2805 of March 10th, or Crime Stoppers on 0800 555 111, where anonymity can be maintained." And that was a report by Herald Scotland staff. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 18th of March, from the news section, Fire Brigade Union sends surplus Scottish emergency kit to Gaza. Report by Jodie Harrison. The Fire Brigade Union, FBU, has called for an end to collective punishment of the population of Gaza as it prepares to make a life-saving donation to the war-torn region. FBU members have refitted a surplus fire engine and gathered equipment they no longer use to give to Palestinian emergency crews. The donation is the latest in a series made by Scottish Union members, which has seen surplus equipment shared with colleagues in the Middle East. The ongoing programme has been delivered through exchange visits, training and the provision of breathing apparatus, firefighting kit and equipment. The latest initiative will see a surplus fire appliance donated by the Scottish Fire and Rescue Service, fitted out with modern firefighting equipment delivered to Palestine later this year. This will be the third fire appliance donated since 2011. Jim Malone, a former firefighter and FBU official who coordinates the union's work in Palestine, said, "The situation in Gaza is appalling. The people are being subjected to unimaginable horrors on a daily basis. There is an urgent need for supplies to alleviate the humanitarian crisis that has unfolded. Our comrades in the Palestinian Fire and Rescue Service battle every hour to save lives as the Israeli government continues its collective punishment of the civilian population. Whilst carrying out their duties, they have come under sustained attacks from Israeli forces." He added, "We hope that the delivery of this fire appliance later this year will help protect the lives of innocent men, women and children, but our greatest hope is for a permanent peace and justice for the people of Palestine." And that report was by Jodie Harrison.
From the Herald Scotland, Sunday the 17th of March. From the business section. Exclusive. Hamza Yousaf facing questions over undeclared family rental properties. This article is an exclusive by Tom Gordon, political editor. Hamza Yousaf is facing questions about why he hasn't publicly declared his family's £1.3 million rental property, Empire, in his register of ministerial interests. The First Minister lists a single rental property in Dundee owned by his wife, Nadia El Nakla. However, he has not included the eight rental properties in Glasgow owned by his parents and their accountancy firm, Yousaf & Co Limited. He has also spoken about private landlords, rent caps and eviction procedures in Parliament without orally declaring any interest. The Scottish Government said Mr Yousaf had only declared his wife's rental flat as he could be seen as direct beneficiary of it. However, the Scottish Tories said the First Minister needed to be fully transparent. There is no suggestion of any wrongdoing by Mr Yousaf's parents. MSPs must declare their own financial holdings, such as rental properties, in a Holyrood register. But ministers are held to a higher standard and also complete a second, more detailed register overseen by the Scottish Government's top official, the Permanent Secretary. The Scottish Ministerial Code states that it is the personal responsibility of each minister to decide whether and what action is needed to avoid a conflict or the perception of a conflict, taking account of advice received from the Permanent Secretary. Declarations should cover interests of the minister's spouse or partner and close family which might be thought to give rise to a conflict. Immediate family includes parents, siblings or children, where an interest might be thought to give rise to an actual or perceived conflict. The code says, additional care is taken in considering which interests held by minister family members should be included in the list so as to avoid excessive and unreasonable intrusion into their lives. It is important to recognise the right of these individuals to a degree of privacy over their affairs and also to avoid compromising their ability to continue in gainful trade and or employment. Accordingly, judgments are made about which interests are directly and significantly relevant and should therefore be included in the list. During the 2016 to 2021 Parliament, when he was Transport Minister and Justice Secretary, Mr Yousaf did not declare any family interest in the Ministerial Register. After he became Health Secretary in 2021, he declared that his sister was a practicing pharmacist and three cousins were dentists in Scotland, two of whom were practice owners. In his current entry, the First Minister declares that his wife is an SNP councillor in Dundee, is a therapist, and that she owns a rental property in Dundee, indicating the property is considered directly and significantly relevant. The property in this case is a flat bought for £82,000 in 2021. However, Mr Yousaf has not included the rental properties owned by his parents, Mustafa and Shaista, or the accountancy firm in which they are the sole directors and shareholders. He has also spoken about landlords, rents and evictions at Holyrood without referring to them. For instance, in January, he announced that the Scottish Government's forthcoming housing bill would set out proposals for longer-term reform of the rental sector. He told MSPs at FMQs, "We are committed to working not just with tenants, which is crucial, but with responsible landlords and other key stakeholders." According to public records, Yousaf & Co Limited owns six flats across Glasgow on Albert Drive, Albert Road, Brand Street, McCulloch Street, Marwick Street and Maxwell Road, which are currently listed as residential lets in the Scottish Landlord Register. All are let via an agent, TPS Lets Limited of Glasgow. The flats were bought for between £27,000 and £132,000 between 2001 and 2019. However, the Zoopla property website estimates are now collectively worth around £850,000. The First Minister's father also owns a flat in his own name in Glenapp Street, and the First Minister's mother owns one in Melville Street. Both appear as rental properties in the Scottish Landlord Register, and are let through an agent. The first was bought for £48,000 in 1999, and the second appears to have been inherited in 2008. Together, The two flats are now estimated by Zoopla to be worth around £475,000. Altogether, the eight rental properties are worth an estimated £1.3 million. The property folio could potentially give rise to a perceived conflict of interest for Mr. Yousaf. In May 2020, he voted on and agreed to the coronavirus legislation that changed the rules on tenancies and evictions, while one of the family's tenants was heading for eviction, as they had been in arrears for more than 3 months. Records from Scotland's Housing and Property Chamber show that a property agent acting for Mr. Yousaf's father applied to a tribunal for a payment order and an eviction order for the flat in Albert Road in Glasgow, owned by Yousaf & Co Limited. The documentation said that the tenant was due to pay £450 a month in rent, but had run up arrears of £4,950 to August 2020. In February 2021, the tribunal agreed to make both the payment order and eviction order. Scottish Tory housing spokesman Miles Briggs said, "Eyebrows will be raised at the submission from Hamza Yousaf in relation to his parents' extensive property interests. Given the public's keen and growing interest in all things housing, the onus is on the First Minister to be fully transparent and ensure he is leading by example in relation to his register of interests." A Scottish Government spokesperson said, "The First Minister includes his wife's rental property in his listed interests, in line with his commitment to be transparent about interests to which he could be perceived to be a direct beneficiary. This is not the case with the rental properties owned by the First Minister's parents. Therefore, they are not required to be declared." And that article was an exclusive by Tom Gordon.
The Herald on the 19th March and the news section. J.K. Rowling will not delete posts over ludicrous hate crime laws by Jody Harrison. J.K. Rowling has said she will not delete the social media posts which could breach ludicrous hate crime laws. The Harry Potter author, 58, slammed the Hate Crime and Public Order Scotland Act, which comes into effect on April 1. It comes after she was embroiled in a misgendering row with transgender broadcaster India Willoughby. The controversial legislation will make it an offence to stir up hatred against protected characteristics, including age, disability, religion, sexual orientation, and gender identity. However, concerns have been raised over the potential criminalisation of freedom of expression. Police in Northumbria have cleared Ms. Rowling of criminality after she stated India is cosplaying a misogynistic male fantasy of what a woman is. And now writing on X, the author responded to messages that she should delete the comments prior to the law coming into effect. But she responded, "If you genuinely imagine I delete posts calling a man, so as not to be protected under this ludicrous law, stand by for the mother of all April Fool's jokes." Ms. Rowling has been highly critical of the new hate crime legislation, arguing the police are going to be very busy when it becomes law. Earlier this month, Northumbria Police said, "On Monday, March 4, we received a complaint about a post on social media. While we recognise the upset may have been caused, the post was reviewed and did not meet the criminal threshold. The complainant has been updated of this." At the time, Miss Willoughby said the author had definitely committed a crime. She added, "I'm legally a woman. She knows I'm a woman and calls me a man. It's a protected characteristic." Miss Willoughby also took to social media after the police ruling to state she had received an avalanche of hate and abuse, including death threats, adding, "I don't feel safe." Ms. Rowling said she had also received a significant amount of murder and torture threats. Ms. Rowling has also been a fierce critic of the Scottish Government's gender reform plans, arguing the proposals would have infringed on women's safety. And that was by Jody Harrison.
This is from the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 19th of March, 2024, from the business section. North-South Electrical Spine to Export Energy to England. This article is by Kathleen Nutt. A new North-to-South electrical spine could be created to allow green energy generated off the coast of Scotland to be transported to England as part of a £60 billion plan, according to a report published today. The study by the Electricity System Operator, the ESO, the organisation which runs the network, said the new infrastructure could carry electricity produced off Peterhead to Merseyside and help meet growing demand from households and businesses across Scotland and the north of England. However, it added that the proposal was an early stage option which will require further consideration and consultation. The ESO report said an additional £60 billion will need to be invested in the electricity grid by the end of the decade to ensure that it can supply the power to keep homes and businesses going. It added that around 20,000 jobs could be created in the largest build-out of the network for 7 decades, with 9 in 10 of these jobs outside London and the South East. Great Britain is about to embark upon the biggest change to the electricity network since the high voltage transmission grid was established back in the 1950s, the report said. It called for swift and coordinated progress, without which the country's climate ambitions might be at risk. The ESO is currently owned by the National Grid, but will transfer into government ownership later this year. The organisation's report warned that new connections and more capacity will be needed as people and companies switch to using electricity for their cars, requiring new capacity in the grid. But the new forms of generating energy, primarily through wind and solar farms, will also change the way the grid is shaped, it said. Once a vast majority of Britain's electricity came from massive coal-fired power plants built close to coal mines. The power grid then moved this energy into Britain's cities and industrial areas. The grid of the future will, by design, instead source its electricity from locations spread out across the country to take into account different weather conditions on different parts of the country on the same day. For instance, sometimes it is windy on the east coast, but not the west, so having turbines in both places can keep supplies more constant. But this means that the grid will have to reach places where it has previously only had small capacity, not least offshore. The report said there will have to be 86 gigawatts of offshore wind in Britain's waters alone, up from 14 gigawatts today. Today, there is only 63 gigawatts of offshore wind in the world. That will help to satiate a jump in demand for electricity. Britain's needs are expected to rise by 64% by 2035 and to double by 2050, the ESO's report said. Investment in renewable energy generation has exceeded investment in transmission capacity over the past decade, resulting in bottlenecks on the electricity network, the report said. This means that energy is being wasted as the grid cannot transport it to where it can be used. For instance, if wind turbines in Scotland are producing more electricity than Scotland can use, or export to England and elsewhere, then the grid has to pay wind farms to switch off some of their turbines. This practice, known as curtailment in industry jargon, cost the grid £569.7 million last year, according to the UK Wind Curtailment Monitor. But like the construction of new wind and solar farms, train lines, housing and much else, the expansion of new grid infrastructure can often run into opposition from local groups. One way to avoid local opposition from people who are worried about spoilt views is to bury the cables. But that comes with trade-offs. Underground cables cost around 5 times as much as overhead cables, are harder to maintain, and are more disruptive during construction. Meanwhile, offshore cables, another solution which does not spoil views, can be up to 8 times more expensive over short distances and can disrupt sensitive marine ecosystems. The UK government has recently suggested that communities impacted by new grid infrastructure should be given substantial financial incentives to win local support. There are also other ways of managing the country's future energy needs, which can reduce the requirement for massive expansion. That can include locating big users of power, such as factories, close to where power is being generated, reducing the need for new long cables. There will also be a role for what in industry jargon is called demand flexibility. This means that by managing not how much electricity people and businesses use, but when they use it, it can take the strain off the grid during peak periods, reducing the need for expansive expansion of the grid. If this demand flexibility is introduced in certain areas, it could save consumers £5 billion, the ESO said. A UK Department for Energy Security and Net Zero spokesman said, "These are preliminary plans published by the Electricity Systems Operator, the ESO. Any project taken forward would be required to progress through a robust planning process. Over 40% of our electricity is now from renewable sources, up from just 7% in 2010. To keep up with growing demand, work to reinforce the grid would connect more low-cost offshore wind and low-carbon energy, helping to future-proof our energy supply, reduce bills, and bring the UK closer to our net zero goals. This would also support over 20,000 jobs and help deliver around £58 billion of investment in the grid through the 2030s. The Scottish Government has been approached for comment." That article was by Kathleen Nutt.
That concludes this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Fair Review. Tell your friends about our service.